Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold, the JBJS podcast brought to you by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld. For those who are listening in for the first time, this is where we cover the best and the rest, as well as the brightest of orthopedic research in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. This is about our 15th take thus far, so I'm running out of energy, but I have more coffee here with me, so hopefully we can make this happen. I'm just kidding. We do this on one take. That's the professionals that we are. This is episode 67. They've been letting us do this for 66 episodes, and there's no indication that we'll be stopping anytime soon. This is October 1st, if you're listening when we drop, because of course, the tens of listeners that we have always do for the October 2nd issue of JBJS. We will be covering everything in the October 2nd issue, highlighting the best of research with a dose of entertainment and pop culture when we can. I am Andrew Schoenfeld, the deputy editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. And I have with me
Antonia Chen, who is a deputy editor for the Reconstruction.
What you hear from us are our opinions, not those of the editor-in-chief at the journal or in the JBJS metaverse or the constituent editors of the other subsidiary journals in the JBJS family or the board of trustees, board of directors, people who work at 20 Pickering Street, and what have you. This is brought to you by CME at JBJS. Get your lifelong learning needs on at CME through the website. Subscribe. I'm not just an advertiser. I also subscribe myself. I just re-up my subscription and I am able to get all the CME I need for the year to renew my license without having to leave the comfort of my office or home office. Anywhere I do that, it's always in the office. Besides that, our takes are hot, sometimes intentionally so. We need those clicks. Pass this on to other individuals that you may think are interested and who may also like our content. If you're already liked and subscribed, we appreciate it. If you're not, hit the notification bell. Give us a 5-star rating. Check out our back issues. Let's get into it. The top of the pile. Review of the Influences of Sex Differences on Health and Disease. What is the Role of Journals by Regan Steiner? This is in the continuing series that started in the summer for the Sex and Gender Symposium at JBJS, sponsored by the NIH. The second article, also in that series, The Impact of a Lack of Reporting of Sex and Gender in Clinical Research on the Continuum of Medical Education by Paul and colleagues. And then Update on Atypical Femoral Fractures by Anderson, followed by The March of Time, The Orthopedic Odyssey from Cradle to Twilight. This is by Ghanem. It's permanently free. Intriguing title. You should definitely check it out. It doesn't cost you anything. As I said, it is free. Then we have Ethical Considerations of Declining Surgical Intervention, Balancing Patient Wishes with Fiduciary Responsibility. Another intriguing article by Lajum. And then we have the AOA Critical Issue Symposium, Gun Violence as a Public Health Crisis by Miller. Last article in the top of the pile section, 15-year results of a comparative analysis of tendon repair versus physiotherapy for small to medium-sized rotator cuff tears, a concise follow-up of previous reports by Moosmayer and colleagues. This does come with an infographic, and it is permanently free. Moving on to the headlines, what's new and exciting in the news this week, my article is Short-Term Complications of Arthroscopic Bristow or Latter-J Procedure with Screw versus Suture Button Fixation, a prospective study of 308 consecutive cases by a single surgeon. This is by Shao and colleagues. So this is a study evaluating patients in a single surgeon practice who underwent arthroscopic Bristow or Latter-J procedures between November of 2016 and April of 2021. The authors collected data at baseline, 3 months, 6 months, and then every consecutive year following surgery for those who were eligible. Their goal was to look at the risk of postoperative complications and unplanned reoperations in this cohort. So they had a total of 412 patients. It's an admirable number. Again, this is collected over roughly 4.5-year time window, November 2016 to April of 2021. 67% underwent a Bristo, while 39 patients underwent a Lattergey, 18 with screw and 21 with suture button. For the Bristo, 165 had a screw and 104 with a suture button. And they had 82 patients reporting a total of 85 complications within 2 years of the surgery. Rates of recurrent dislocation or subluxation and infection were quite low, approximately 2% for the former and 0.6% for the latter. And only 4 individuals or 1.3% had unplanned reoperations. So that right off the bat is going to impair the prognostic capacity for this work. They are graded as level 2 evidence. It's a single surgeon practice, single surgeon case series. There's the potential for selection indication bias, expertise bias as well, with limited event rates. I don't see how this really would meet the level 2 criteria per se, especially since some of the variables that they're considering lack translational capacity. So what do we mean by that? They found that paying with rural insurance, for example, and poor sleep quality prior to surgery were associated with increased risk of any complications. So rural insurance is a construct that is likely, and I would say really assuredly, not translatable to other contexts. That's going to be very unique to the clinical context in which this work was done. For example, there isn't anything in the U.S. that actually is rural insurance. Could there be, could you extrapolate and say this is a disadvantaged group or a lower socioeconomic group? I guess that's possible, but you know, that would be putting a lot of words into the mouths of the authors. There are a few other issues. You know, they say the purpose of the study was to investigate complications within 2 years after arthroscopic coracoid transfer for anterior instability utilizing different surgical techniques. There's obviously an indication bias about whether they chose Bristo or Lattergey. Obviously, the Bristo was more common, and then whether or not they're going to use a screw or a suture button fixation. What those characteristics are, how those decisions factor into how the surgeon selects the procedure, are exactly, you know, what we talk about when there are going to be issues with translational capacity or generalizability. And they also perform stepwise logistic regression, which can be an additional concern because there's a restricted event rate across a number of these parameters, with limited numbers, which means that they may be underpowered in terms of secondary tests and interactions. For our regular listeners, you know, I would prefer a conceptual model in this case rather than stepwise logistic regression, which can introduce artifacts and create some spurious findings that, again, impair translational capacity. They also assess PROMs using a tiered, layered regression approach using linear regression. PROMs would be expected to be a non-parametric outcome, and that also can lead to spurious point estimates and 95% confidence intervals. I would say this is a retrospective review of prospectively collected data, large number of series of patients. Those are, you know, really the main advantages. How translational or not this is going to be is probably in the eye of the end user. Obviously, there's, you know, concerns for expertise bias. If you're of practice and your decision points are not like those of this surgeon, or even, you know, your ability or facility with these types of procedures are not the same as the surgeon, the outcomes would obviously be different. I would take the risk factor analysis that they do with a grain of salt, because again, all factors that are considered in the model, such as these parameters around rural insurance or things such as poor sleep quality, which may be influential solely due to chance, or maybe not because of other underlying factors for which it's a proxy or a mediator, may not be translatable in your own clinical practice. That's what I have on this one. I don't know if you have anything that you want to add on that front.
No, I agree with what you're saying. You know, it's a single surgeon series, so that's always a little concerning just because it is more narrow and it's how someone operates and how someone does things. One thing I'm curious about always is, I know this is a short-term complications view, but like, have there been any changes in procedures or anything like that between 2016 and 2021? That's always something I think about in that time frame. But I agree with what you're saying with regards to insurance and all those other areas. So it's a narrow scope.
Yeah, I would call it a clinical retrospective of this surgeon's practice and experience. And that can be informative in some respects, particularly around natural history and things like that, especially with 412 patients, but it may not be as generalizable as one may assume off the bat. Okay. So let's move into your headline, far cortical locking versus standard constructs for lock plate fixation in the treatment of acute displaced fractures of the distal femur, a multi-center randomized trial by Lefebvre and colleagues. There is a commentary, there's a visual summary, and it is 30 days free. So you hit the trifecta on this one.
We got them all.
What's up?
So we're looking at distal femur fractures here, and these are difficult to heal fractures. And there's often multiple treatment options, but the traditional way of doing this is through locking screws and bridge plating. What this study wanted to do was compare that traditional method with far cortical locking screws that have more controlled flexibility. And most previous studies had either been non-comparative, either just looking at traditional or just looking at far cortical locking screws, or retrospective in nature. So this study was a prospective randomized trial comparing these two constructs, and they're performed across 16 centers in the US and Canada, and they included adult patients with an AO or OTA type 33A or 33C distal femoral fracture, and they're suitable for bridge fixation and treated within 14 days of injury. And the time frame of the study was January 2013 to May 2022. And they excluded periprosthetic fractures, most importantly. They did also exclude open fractures that required flaps or vascular repair, or those with surgical management that included an interfragmentary lag fixation of a non-articular fracture. So example, non-bridge fixation. If patients weren't ambulatory before their injury or had any concomitant lower extremity injury that required non-weight bearing for greater than 6 weeks after the injury, were also excluded. If they had a lack of bone substance or poor bone quality that couldn't sustain bridge plating, they were excluded. If they had an active local infection and the addition of bone graft or adjunct to their surgery, they had to be excluded. And if the patient had no radiographic follow-up, they were also excluded because part of their final score, their primary outcome was radiological outcome. Patients with bilateral injuries were eligible, but only the more severe fracture for each patient were included and randomized. And that is a subjective score of what's, you know, more severe fracture. Patients were randomly alternating blocks of four and six treatment allocations and stratified randomization on the basis of age. The delineation was greater than 65 or less than 65, and fracture severity, open versus closed. They did use the same implant company for plates, which is good. The standard group had locking only, non-locking, and hybrid constructs, so it was a little bit more open. The far cortical locking screws group had four bicortical motion lock screws for fixation in the shaft with no specified working length. And the primary outcome was this composite fracture healing at 3 months of fixation. So there was one component of it, which was radiographic healing. And this was read by blinded readers, and it used a modified RUSS score. And the bridging of one or more cortices with a stable construct was how it was rated. And the second portion of this primary outcome was clinical fracture healing. And they used the Fix-It score, or the function index for trauma score. And it went from 0 to 6 for weight bearing and 0 to 6 for fracture site pain, with, you know, 6 being a good thing in terms of like you're able to fully weight bear and you have less pain. And so 12 was a good score. And then secondary outcomes kind of broke these down. They had a radiographic healing one, a clinical fracture healing one, complications, reoperations, and health-related quality of life based on the SF-36 score. And they have a physical component and mental component. And they looked at this both at 3, 6, and 12 months after fixation. They did a sample size calculation of 138. They assumed a loss to follow-up, and their goal was 165 patients. They estimated between group differences with the use of the win ratio approach with multiple other statistical tests that you know better than I do. They assessed 1,419 patients for eligibility, and they excluded 1,223 patients, which is a lot of patients that were excluded. There were 3 randomization errors, and so they had 96 patients in the far cortical locking group and 97 patients in the standard screw group as their final cohort. They did, sorry, not as their final cohort, as their initial cohort after all those exclusion criteria. And then 26 patients were excluded after randomization as a result of surgical protocol errors, which were 15 of them, screening errors, consent withdrawal. So they had 167 patients in the final analysis, with 84 assigned to the far cortical locking screws and 83 assigned to standard screws. The distribution of fracture type between the OTA 33A and 33C was almost 50-50, with 2.4% missing data. Three patients who were randomly assigned to the far cortical locking screws crossed over to standard screw treatment, but none of the ones assigned to the standard screw treatment crossed over to the far cortical locking ones. Patients assigned to far cortical locking screws had better outcomes or wins in 51% based on between group pairwise comparisons. Patients assigned to standard screws had better outcomes in 44% of the comparisons, and the outcomes were tied in 5% of the comparisons. The calculated win ratio was 1.18. Radiographic healing didn't differ significantly between groups, and of the 138 patients in the with the fix-it data, which is the clinical outcomes at 3 months, the scores were similar. And in terms of the SF-36 physical scores at 3 months and 12 months was not different. And in terms of the mental score at 3 months or 12 months were not different between groups. And the groups had similar proportion of patients who experienced adverse events. They did do a subgroup analysis, kind of looking at a little bit more refined detail. And they said the subgroup point estimates suggest potentially better outcomes with far cortical locking screws in younger patients and patients with greater than 4 centimeters of medial comminution. But these differences did not reach statistical significance. It kind of felt like they were trying to find something in the realm of what they had done. So there are limitations to the study. Only 97% of patients had data available for inclusion and analysis of the primary outcome at 3 months, let alone 12 months. Despite the stratification, they did find an imbalance between the groups with respect to patients with open versus closed fractures. So that could have impacted the way that these constructs performed. I do commend the authors on performing a randomized controlled trial. These are hard to do. And it was good to look at different methods of fixation to determine if there's a better one. It seems like from their data, it shows that there's not much difference between groups in the confines of this RCT based on a lot of exclusion criteria. But these findings can be considered clinically relevant and are applicable to practice. So I can encourage authors to do randomized controlled trials. It is nice to do multi-site trials, but it is hard to keep following up on patients and making sure that everything is done in the appropriate manner.
Yeah, and working within the trauma population, I would add, is particularly challenging, of course, and that is a well-known fact. You know, there's certainly no faults here from the randomized trial side. It was done especially well methodologically. I would say, obviously, with the exclusion criteria and things like that, you know, it just may be that the far cortical locking screw constructs play a more important role in you know, I'm just postulating here. This is not scientific dogma as far as I'm concerned, but, you know, maybe it's the more challenging fractures that they're going to perform better in. And, you know, they just didn't have a sufficient number of those to really, you know, show that difference. When you look at their patients assigned to the FCL screws had better outcomes in 51% of the comparisons, while their point estimate is 1.18. I mean, that's pretty much as close to a coin toss as you can get it, right? Like, it doesn't really seem within the universe of the fracture types that they included here that there's really any decided advantage.
Completely agree. So, further studies.
All right. You know, when you listen to when you read the transcript of your case is on hold, like if you're following along, looking at either the subtitles or just read the transcript, it actually says it's your cases, like plural, like all your cases are on hold. It's not just the one case. It's
so you're here for a long haul, guys. You're here to listen for fun.
But then it also says that I am Dr. Andrew Schoenthal. So,
ooh, there you go.
The AI isn't working so well on that feature. Anyhow, we'll see if this particular case is going to go on hold. The 2-year outcomes of primary arthroscopic surgery in patients with femoroacetabular impingement a comparative study of labral repair and labral reconstruction by Doman and colleagues. This comes with a comment, so if we put it on hold, you can listen to somebody else and see if they also put it on hold, or if they're saying you are green to go at our elite employed surgery center. Then this is also 30 days free, so there's no excuse to not run and check it out as soon as you possibly can. So the goal of this study, very similar to my headline in some respects, comparing minimum two-year patient-reported outcomes and the risk of revision or conversion to arthroplasty for patients who underwent primary labral reconstruction versus primary labral repair. So this is patients with femoroacetabular impingement forming the substrate, underwent primary hip arthroscopy with labral repair or reconstruction performed by a singular surgeon between 2006 and 2018. So right off the bat there, there is some concern for secular trends that I did not really see were effectively handled in the analytic approach. Obviously, a number of parameters can change, including surgeon experience, like their own individual experience over the course of more than a decade doing these cases. They have 150 hips who underwent the labral reconstruction, and then they have close to 1,000 hips who underwent primary labral repair. So that right there, when you're reading an article and you see those kinds of like major disparities, it's like, you know, an order of magnitude higher in terms of a number of cases for one procedure versus the other, there's clear concern for selection and indication bias, which the authors are upfront about. And they're going to try and use causal inference techniques to address that. In this case, we're talking about inverse probability weighting. Now, they had good follow-up time, 5.3 years in the reconstruction group, 5.8 in the repair group, and they are looking to see the effects that this may have in terms of the reconstruction. My concern being that a reconstruction implicates a more severe issue at baseline than a repair does. So obviously, you have like 1,000 cases of repair, you have only 150 of reconstruction. You want to sort of balance that out almost as you would with a randomized trial. That's the goal of causal inference testing. You can do that with propensity score matching. You can do it with inverse probability weighting using a propensity score. That's really what they did here, inverse propensity score weighting to estimate average treatment effects. With 1,000 hips undergoing the repair, I feel like they could have done a propensity score. I mean, these are, you know, distinctions without a difference to some degree. But the approach, regardless, whether it's propensity score or matching or weighting, it really comes down to, are you able to really get at comparable patients where there really could have been equipoise? And that means that, you know, there's going to be a certain set of patients with the reconstruction who there's no way that they would have gotten a repair. And then there are a certain number of repair patients who there's no way they would have gotten a reconstruction. Now, that's going to be easier to delineate and deliberate on if you do a match. It's much harder to do when you're just talking about using the inverse probability of treatment weights, as we've done here. Also, are the factors that you're considering in your propensity model really those that drive the decision-making? And that also, I think, is open to question, because they have labral treatment, group, age, sex, joint space, alpha angle, lateral center edge angle. All of those can, you know, be parameters in any patient, and whether it really gets at your ability to repair versus you need to reconstruct the labrum, which to my mind portends a more severe state of affairs within the context of the joint. It shouldn't surprise you that those would be at a higher risk of eventually needing a total hip arthroplasty, which is what they found. 20% versus 7%, the adjusted odds being 3.2. There are a couple of different additional issues that cause some concern for me. One, you know, again, you can look at their figure one and decide for yourself if you feel these factors are really those that are going to play into a decision of repair versus reconstruction. But then, you know, they have these covariates and they say they limited themselves to the six covariates following, this is quote, following the rule of thumb that one covariate should be allowed for every 10 positive binary endpoint cases. So first off, it's not a rule of, you shouldn't use the term rule of thumb anymore anyway, but it's not a rule. This isn't a rule. It's a there's a spectrum. You can be very permissive and do that like 1 per 10, which is probably the most permissive that you can get away with. You know, you could do 1 for 1 if you wanted to, but people aren't really going to accept that. You know, generally we like to see 20 events per factor that you're going to include. That's also supposed to account for the intercept. Maybe that's too methodologically rigorous for some, but it all comes down to, are you going to be very permissive or are you going to be very strict? The stricter you are, the more likely it is that what you're getting is real translatable facts as opposed to artifacts or just kind of fuzzy fudging that's associated with the model. More strict means more translatable, more generalizable. Less strict obviously means less so. The same goes for the propensity score piece. People want to treat propensity scores like it's a Harry Potter spell, and you just say propensity score Macchiaveo, and then it eliminates all the confounding in your model, and you have a simulated randomized trial. That isn't the way it is. You can be real permissive on the propensity match, so permissive, in fact, that you could get 20-year-olds matched with 80-year-olds, or you can be super strict so that it really does actually, every match is, you know, painstakingly sought out and handpicked like the Civil War chess pieces from the National Mint. But there's obviously a spectrum, and what you're willing to agree to is really going to inform how you find this useful and translational to your own practice. The other point that I wish to discuss for the edification of the listeners is that they used linear regression to model postoperative outcomes, patient-reported outcomes, which again, as was already mentioned in the earlier headline, would be expected to be non-parametric. They do have enough patients to say that central limits might obviate that, but you know, we'd like to see it at least considered. That's what I have on this one. I think that there are some useful aspects. I think it's an interesting question. I think it's a challenging question and one that's very difficult to get at in a study like this.
No, I completely agree with you. I see the other end of this, right? Where they come in for their total hip replacements. And, you know, labor repair, labor reconstructions are two different animals. So, you know, it's not saying you're randomizing one to another per se. They have different causes. They have different reasons for undergoing each procedure. So it's hard to say that you're comparing apples to apples. It's a little bit of apples to oranges thing. It is good for hip arthroscopists and understanding how to counsel a patient saying this is where you're potentially going to go, but they are different procedures. And so just understanding that there's different procedures for different reasons, it doesn't necessarily mean that's something that is a problem or not.
100%. I think we're running out of time. We got to get through the honorable mentions. Let's get into it. Lateral wall integrity of the greater tuberosity is important for the stability of osteoporotic proximal humeral fractures after plate fixation by Kim and colleagues, 30 days free. Here they have 10 matched pairs of cadaveric humeri, right and left, assigned to surgical neck fracture alone or a surgical neck fracture with greater trochanteric lateral wall comminution. And then modeled fixation. And severe comminution of the greater tuberosity lateral wall significantly compromised the biomechanical stability of osteoporotic comminuted humeral surgical neck fractures. So they do recognize this is an extreme clinical scenario, but nonetheless, they say that severe comminution of the greater tuberosity lateral wall significantly compromised the stability of their constructs, and that should be taken into account when you're looking to engage in fixation with a plate and screws alone. Next, we have minimal clinical important difference for the short musculoskeletal functional assessment in patients with severe lower extremity fractures. Pooled data from 7 multicenter prospective clinical trials by Carlini. This study sought to create distributional MCIDs using a large cohort of research participants with severe lower extremity fractures. I think this is, you know, very useful and will be highly cited in future research. They found that the MCID can be defended in a range of 7 and 11 points for the dysfunction index, and then 11 and 17 points for the bother index, sort of a normalization of sorts that can then be cited and then extrapolated to further research. They did recognize that differences exist between these MCID values based on the calculation method, but were really consistent across the categories of the various subgroups that they considered, which I think is good face validity. And then we get into mapping the course of recovery following limb salvage surgery for soft tissue sarcoma of the extremities by Lazaridis. This is a study that included 916 patients, so a very large sample, describing the typical course of functional recovery following limb salvage resection of soft tissue sarcoma and looking to identify factors associated with delayed postoperative course of recovery. They found that most patients will achieve their maximal recovery within 2 to 3 years following surgical resection. Those with older age, larger tumor size, osseous resection, motor nerve resections, postoperative complications, and tumor recurrence, probably not surprising, have poor functional outcomes and delayed courses of recovery. We're about out of time at this point. We'll try and do better next time. Thanks for sticking with us. If you like what you heard, tune in 2 weeks when Dr. Chen will be heading things up. And we'll be talking about another set of amazing articles in JBJS. If you didn't like what you heard, give us another chance. Thanks for staying with us this long. And be sure, again, to hit the like and notification, subscribe, listen to us on Stitcher, Pastos, Amazon, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. I think your cases are still on hold here, but hopefully your cases in real life are always green and ready to go.
Thanks for joining. Until next time.